Sally King has been a trustee of the Peace Council from almost its inception. She is professor and head of the Department of Philosophy and Religion at James Madison University, which is in Harrisonburg, Virginia. She is formerly president of the Society for Buddhist Christian Studies. She's a renowned scholar of Buddhism, particularly Buddhist social engagement. She is co-clerk of the Harrisonburg Friends Meeting and the co-editor of the really well-reviewed volume, Engaged Buddhism, Buddhist Liberation Movements in Asia. And Sally, you're probably tired of having people point out that your co-editor, Sally King's co-editor in this volume, is Christopher Queen.
Exactly, and I always tell them, just notice I'm the king, he's the queen.
You're the king, he's the queen. Well, welcome, and we're really glad you're here today. And the topic that we have chosen together is non-judgment and justice, and I'm going to invite you to say a little bit more about that in a moment. We also will be talking, as we go through these 10 weeks, we're going to be making reference from time to time to the idea of cultural evolution, that we're living in an age of cultural evolution, something that Barbara Marx Hubbard knows a great deal about. And so for each of the material pages that you might take a look at, for each of the conversations, we've provided a little outline, some questions, and each one has links to works where you can read more about the topic and read some of the writings of the person that we're interviewing. And also, always there's a little excerpt from my book, Thriving in the Cross Current, which talks about the idea of cultural sea change. Sally, as we begin, because people aren't so familiar with the Peace Council, I wonder if I could invite you, and I'm going to do this each week, invite you just to share a memory or something about your experience with the Peace Council that maybe captures a little bit of the flavor of what this group has been about for so long, since its founding in 1995.
Sure, and thank you for inviting me. Well, since you mentioned Bishop Ruiz, I've also been thinking about him since we got word about his passing, and I thought I'd just tell a story about him because there are so many stories, so many remarkable people in the Peace Council. But I remember one time we were having a meeting of the Peace Council, and people were coming into the room, and we had heard and sort of been talking among ourselves that Bishop Ruiz's sister had been attacked in the diocese offices recently. And we didn't know what the status of it was, but we did know that some thugs had entered the diocese offices. Bishop Ruiz himself was not there, but his sister was, and they attacked her and hit her many times on the head with a hammer, which obviously sounds quite dreadful. And so when Bishop Ruiz came in the room, he was all smiles, and we said to him, you know, Bishop Ruiz, how is your sister? And he just laughed and said, oh, we always told her it's a good thing she has such a hard head. And that was just, that's almost a snapshot of what the people, a number of the people in the Peace Council are like, really facing horrendous situations, many of them, with incredible courage, and that kind of courage in a moment of crisis to sort of rise above it, but also in Bishop Ruiz's case and really many people's case on the Peace Council, also the courage to just be there and stay with this intransigent situation, you know, day after day, year after year, decade after decade, and usually, you know, very little attention, very little glory, working with very, very poor people, you know, in a struggle with paramilitaries against you and the federal government of Mexico against you and the state government against you and the Vatican against you, but the people are with you. And just to stay with that and work with that slowly with such steadfastness and such faithfulness. So just you know, really amazing examples of what a human being can be.
Well, as we begin to talk about, that's a wonderful memory, and as we begin to talk about the idea of non-judgment and justice, and particularly from a Buddhist perspective on this critical idea of justice, I want you to remember with us a time when we were gathered in Jerusalem, and it was Holocaust Memorial Day, We had gathered, as you recall, at Hebrew Union College, and we're listening to a presentation by Michael Melchior, who is the dean of Hebrew Union College, and he was talking to us about the importance of remembering. And I wonder if you could take it from there.
Jim, could I interrupt with a technical issue? Because I wanted to get a quick sense of, is Sally's voice on the phone is just a little distant and a little unclear, and I wondered if anyone else was experiencing that could hear in the panel. Jim, are you noticing that?
Sounds pretty good to me, but maybe can we turn it up a little bit, Megan?
The people on the call, if you're having a little trouble understanding Sally, you can vote by pressing 1 on your keypad, and then we'll know if it's worth having her call back in. Yeah, it looks like quite a few people are indicating that they're having a little trouble. So, Jim, maybe you could set up the topic, and Sally, could you just call right back in? Are you on a regular landline?
I am on a landline. I'm wondering, will this work with cell phones? Because maybe my cell phone would work better.
No, the landline's better.
The landline. I can try again, but I think...
Yeah, just try again, and I'll set it up.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
And so I thought that by way of introducing this, as Sally calls in again, is just I'll read you a little bit of what we wrote as a kind of summary introductory piece for this conversation on non-judgment and justice. Does forgiveness require redress of grievances? Does true justice demand retribution or atonement? What are the implications of the Buddhist concepts of non-attachment and non-judgment for the pursuit of social justice and human rights? These are just a few of the questions that we'll take up with Sally King, who is, as a matter of fact, one of the foremost experts on Buddhist social engagement. And Sally argues that while Buddhists generally regard human rights as an important concept, many think that the concept of justice is not so useful, since it's often seen as a prerequisite to, and therefore an impediment to, finding peace. So it's absolutely a fascinating question. And I think when Sally tells you about the conversation that members of the Peace Council had there at Hebrew Union College in Jerusalem on Holocaust Memorial Day, I think you'll be intrigued.
Okay, Sally, are you back?
I am back. How do I sound?
I can hear you pretty well.
Okay, and I'm trying to speak a little louder, so let me know if it's working. So actually, Jim, I thought I would go back to a day or two before that actual event at Hebrew Union College and set the stage a little more. Is that all right?
Sure.
Sure. So we were in Jerusalem, and the Peace Council's habit, usually when we visit a place, there's a peace counselor locally who knows the situation and knows a lot of people involved. So this was all set up and waiting for us, and we spent several days hearing the stories. First of all, I don't remember which was first, but stories of Israelis, quite a group of them, diverse experiences, stories of Palestinian people, again, a diverse group. And I noticed as we were listening to these stories that, you know, everyone was responding with a lot of sympathy and compassion for the stories that they were hearing. But at the same time, I noticed that the Buddhists in the room, and including myself, were starting to squirm. The facial expressions, the body language, there was some discomfort on the Buddhist side, and I was feeling it too, and I didn't know how to understand it, but I noticed it. And then among ourselves, actually, a Thai Buddhist laywoman at the time, her name is Chatsumarn Kabul Singh, she's since become a nun, Venerable Dhammananda, but at the time a laywoman, she kind of broke the ice on the subject, and I think she really spoke for the other Buddhists when she said, "I cannot understand in my heart what the Israelis and the Palestinians are saying." She saw them as nourishing their suffering, and she said, "Our tradition teaches us to let go of it." Well, that was really interesting, and we all were kind of blown away by that, and all the Buddhists in the group were nodding their heads, yeah, that's right, they're nourishing their suffering, whether they're Israelis or whether they're Palestinians, they're nourishing their suffering. And so then a day or two later, we were invited to Hebrew Union College on Holocaust Memorial Day, and we did hear this really extensive program of songs and poems and so forth from the death camps and the Holocaust, and tremendously emotional. And afterwards, we went into a separate room for this conversation with the dean of the college. And this had not been at all planned, but to our surprise, Geshe Sopa, a Tibetan Buddhist monk, began to speak. And he speaks very quietly and has a bit of an accent, so we're all kind of on the edge of our chairs trying to hear him. And what he said was so remarkable. He said, and again speaking to this, small Jewish audience, he said, the Tibetans, look at our situation. The Tibetans were invaded by the Chinese, and we suffered a great deal. Many people lost their lives. Many people lost their homes. And so we ask ourselves, why did the Chinese attack Tibet? And we decide it was a result of karma. We believe this was due to our past karma, our collective karma. That sometime in the past, we Tibetans as a group did something terrible to the Chinese. Our suffering now at the hands of the Chinese is the result of that. And so he says to his Jewish audience, now you think about karma. You might think this way. Maybe in the past, I was one of those German soldiers. That person earned bad karma. Someone else had karma that led him to be born as a Jew and to be killed. With general karma, if a group in the past together killed an enemy, that group would later be reborn and be killed together. We went on to say the main point is to have compassion for mistakes made from an egocentric viewpoint out of ignorance. Sometimes you have a wrong view, and it fills you with hatred, and you do something out of that hatred that earns you negative karma. That must be subject to our compassion. Subject to our love. The Chinese now, he said, are earning terrible karma for what they're doing to us. We must feel compassion for everyone who is suffering on both sides. We don't look at the Chinese as evil, but we try to find a peaceful solution and make them happy and peaceful. So that was what he said, and we all were just shocked and blown away, and there was just complete silence in the room. And I'll just add, the next day we visited the Dehesha camp for Palestinian refugees, and Geshe Sopa did the same thing. He delivered the same speech to this Palestinian audience, and once again, everyone who heard him was just completely stunned and silent.
Jim, I would like to ask a question. I think I might be voicing it on behalf of some of the people in the room.
Sure.
And it's the question which I bet you fielded this before on the topic, which is, does it not presume that another tradition, i.e. the Jews, had some way to embrace or understand the notion of karma in order to reconcile themselves with that position? Because it isn't necessarily a part of Judaism in terms of their worldview. So doesn't it depend on whether or not that tradition embraces the norms or the worldview of another tradition, such as Buddhism?
Well, I think that's part of why there was always this response of just sort of stunned silence. But at the same time, I don't think that a person has to be part of that worldview in order to feel some of the weight, at least, of what Geshe Sopa was saying. Because the thing is, what he's really opening up there is a whole different way of looking at things that includes points like maybe we in some way contributed to this situation. Maybe all the blame isn't entirely on the other side. Maybe it's not the right approach to sit on our side and say we're entirely good and righteous and the other side is entirely evil. Maybe that kind of approach that many of us take to all kinds of conflicts, you know, from the most, you know, conflict within the family to these global conflicts, maybe there's something wrong with that approach. So you don't have to believe in karma per se to, to have that question, that new perspective have some power behind it.
Thank you.
It seems to me that I think that's a really good question, Barbara. And for many in the audience there, of course, what Geshe Sopa, who himself was one of the teachers and examiners of His Holiness the Dalai Lama when he took his higher level exams when he was training. What Geshe Sopa brought up requires, I mean, if we are going to agree with him 100%, we have to believe in rebirth and we have to believe in karma. And I think a lot of people in that room, the majority of people in that room, had no basis for that. But what Sally is saying is that it brings up the whole question of non-attachment, of non-clinging, and perhaps of the examination of my motives. What am I really after when I talk about remembering, not forgetting, hanging on, achieving justice that way? And that leads me, Sally, to throw in two other things into the hopper, if I may. And one is the Buddhist notion of non-attachment. And you don't have to be a Buddhist to understand the idea of non-attachment. In one form or another, we find it in every tradition. And on the other side, something you have often talked about in this context, the notion of revenge, the linking of the concept of justice to retribution, which may perpetuate the conflict. So can you reflect on those two, non-attachment on the one side, revenge on the other?
Sure. Well, there's a lot that can be said. As for the non-attachment, I think one place that that comes in is with respect to the issue of the politics of victimhood, which is the politics based on identity and attachment to an identity. And this has been really, I think, pretty fruitful. In other words, the identity politics of victimhood, the sense that, you know, I'm identifying with a particular group. It might be ethnic, national, religious, combination of all of those. You know, that's who I am, and that's the meaning of this event interpreted in terms of that identity. And I see what's going on here as a wrong that's been done to me or to my group, and I'm going to teach my children that, and I want them to teach their children that, and this gets handed on, and there's some attachment there as well. This gets handed on over the generations. And so on the one hand, and another reason for the silence in the room in the case of the Holocaust Memorial Day presentation, you know, a big part of the Jewish tradition has been Jewish identity, and certainly a, on the one hand, very justified sense of, you know, so many wrongs, you know, terrible, grievous, you know, heinous tragedies and crimes against the Jewish people. And
Sally, excuse me, you may need to speak up just a little bit more directly into the phone. I think
okay.
We're losing you a bit.
So in terms of Jewish identity, this sense of we're a people that has been wronged and oppressed and murdered over the centuries. And on the one hand, you know, you can see that's a perfectly valid thing to identify in terms of. But on the other hand, I remember Rabbi Levi Wyman Kelman, who's also part of the Peace Council. In fact, on the same occasion when we were having these discussions in Jerusalem and the Buddhists were speaking up this way, Levi's response was so interesting. He said, "Now I begin to understand for the first time why so many Jews are interested in Buddhism." He said, "If you're Jewish, you're always told, you know, never forget, remember all these things." And he said, "It becomes an unbearable burden, and you long for a way to put it down, but, you know, you don't know how." And I thought that was so interesting in light of what Chatsumarn Kabelsing had said from a Buddhist point of view. They're nourishing their suffering, and I've been taught to let it go. So the role of how we understand our identity, and from the Buddhist point of view, identity it is something that we have to be not attached to, because the Buddhist understanding is our identity is fluid. It's always changing. It's always in process. And if you think of it more that way, that opens up a more sort of future-oriented kind of sense of identity and, you know, a range of possibilities of considering who I might want to become, who I want to be 5 years from now. So that's one way that non-attachment comes in. You were also asking about revenge, the whole question of revenge.
Right.
It's been very clear in the Buddhist discussions about this that they, as you mentioned, I think, in your introduction, they do use a lot of Western terms in their engagement with global political issues. So they do, for example, often speak about human rights. So it's not that they don't feel they have something to learn from Western perspectives, and not that they don't want to use those tools when they're useful. But they rarely, very rarely, use the term justice. And in interviewing a lot of people, Buddhists of various kinds, about justice, first of all, it becomes clear they don't entirely understand what this Western concept of justice is. It's really, there's nothing quite like that in Buddhism. But secondly, to the extent that they hear it used in a popular sense, they really do feel that Westerners, in using the term justice, they're often talking about revenge. They're often talking about, well, again, as Jatsamarn Kabul Singh said, you killed my son, so now your son must die. And she said, if that's your idea of justice, that's no idea of justice at all. So from the Buddhist point of view, revenge, and again, it draws for them on this language, this idea of karma, but I think perhaps maybe in a way that people can identify with a little bit more. Revenge only adds to the cycle. So if you don't mind, I have a very, very short quotation from a Buddhist scripture that I think explains the Buddhist sort
sure,
of
please,
allergy
please.
To revenge. So here's the quotation. It's from the Dhammapada. These are words of the Buddha. Hatred is never appeased by hatred in this world. It is appeased by non-hatred. This is an eternal law. That's the quote. So very strong language. This is an eternal law. That is to say, this is a law of the universe. If you hit somebody and they respond with hatred, they hit you back. Now you want to hit them back. You're never going to get past the cycle. This is karma, you can say. Another word for karma is just cause and effect. If you keep hitting somebody, they're going to hit you back. How will it ever end? So this scripture suggests the only way to appease hatred is by non-hatred, which is to say you have to introduce something else into the equation, some kind of new contribution on a totally different level that involves self-discipline and not acting out of anger, not acting out of hatred, or else the cycle will just continue indefinitely. And what's the use of that from a Buddhist point of view?
I think that's really, really intriguing. And I was going, Sally, to ask you to identify a few places in the world where the kinds of things we've been talking about are most relevant from a Buddhist point of view. But let me rephrase that and ask you something slightly different. That is, you're one of, as I mentioned before, one of the world's great experts in the whole idea of concept of social engagement in Buddhism. Socially engaged Buddhism, if I'm not mistaken, that was a term first used by Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Buddhist monk, is that correct?
That's my understanding.
And when we in the non-Buddhist tradition or in the West, when we think about social engagement, I think most of us probably, if we were to speak a couple of sentences about it, that word justice would pop in pretty early. Can you, I know this isn't fair, it's a vast field, but can you reflect just for a little bit about the Buddhist notion of social engagement and how that might offer a refreshingly different point of view from the one that we might be most conversant with?
Well, you're right, that's a big subject, but it's true that Buddhists don't talk much about justice, and this becomes a kind of a... On the one hand, an occasion for people not understanding each other, and on the other hand, an opportunity for people to get some new ideas. So Buddhist engagement, I think it's fair to say that in some respects Buddhists have not engaged sufficiently with the world, historically speaking, but they are beginning to make up for lost time now, and they are coming from a different direction. I think the foundation of a lot of Buddhist engagement is compassion, which is one of the big values of Buddhism. So if you think about, your audience may not be that familiar with Buddhism, but in a way Buddhism can be summarized by the Four Noble Truths, a basic teaching of the Buddha. The first noble truth is suffering, that there is suffering, and that that's a problem. And the other noble truths go on to say the whole point of Buddhism is to try to do something about suffering. So when I think about the fact that in the West and in a lot of the world, people think immediately of justice when they think about social engagement. From the Buddhist side, I think the lens they're using is the lens of suffering. And if suffering's present, then there's an invitation to become engaged and see if there's something you can do about it. And so that's the goal of Buddhism. And it used to be, of course, similar to Christianity and I imagine other religions, it used to be you'd look at that issue purely spiritually, but in modern times there's been this this movement to look at the issue still spiritually, but also socially on top of that. So you might not think it would make a huge difference, but I think it does make something of a difference. And so sometimes I invite my audiences, when they are engaging with a situation, just as a thought experiment to help their thinking, maybe to open some possibilities up in thinking, try thinking about that situation not in terms of justice. Put all that language aside. You can bring it back later if you want, but put it aside for a time being and think about the situation in terms of suffering. Everyone's suffering, the planet's suffering, the earth's suffering, all peoples, all parties to the situation are probably suffering in some form. And look at that as the issue and see if that takes your the way you respond in a different direction. And if it, and also another question I like to ask is, when you do that, is there anything missing? And this is still, I think, an open question. In other words, is there some work that the word justice does that nothing else will do? You've got to have the concept of justice or you're not dealing adequately with the situation. And this is a thought experiment I've been working on myself for some years. And I have to say I haven't found any situations yet that can't be addressed just with a concern for suffering and leaving justice out of the picture.
And suffering redirecting our thinking, I'm assuming you mean in the direction of our thinking action, in the direction of compassion.
Well, yes, and also in terms of the story that I was telling before of Geshe Sopa and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, if you look at that situation in terms of justice, well, you've got this whole identifying with one side and we're right and the other guys are evil or bad or, you know, unacceptable in some way. All of that kind of stance comes up. Whereas if you look at it in terms of suffering, you know, there's a lot of suffering on both sides. So immediately you begin to look at the situation in terms of, and this is what the Buddhist engagement has done, you're looking for a win-win solution, actually. You're not looking for one side to triumph over the other side. You're looking for something that eliminates the suffering on both sides. Now, that may not be easy to find. You know, this isn't some kind of a magic instant answer to everything. But it's a different approach, and the goal shifts when you do that.
Well, we in our 35 minutes, we have a few minutes left, 5 or 6 minutes left, and I want to ask your thoughts on a little passage that I won't read the passage, but it's included in the materials on the material page for today's conversation, and it's an excerpt from Thriving in the Cross Current, the book I wrote on cultural evolution. But the point is not the excerpt from my book, but the thought of a really remarkable person that we're all familiar with, Walter Wink, the theologian, Joe, by the way, Joe Elder, who will be with us in the panel discussion today, pointed out to me the other day that Walter was a graduate student of his some years ago. So, but Walter Wink has a really interesting approach to the whole idea of justice, and he talks about it in terms of two stories. One story, long dominant in Western culture and world culture, and that's the story of redemptive violence, the myth of redemptive violence. And I've just written here, this story is told in countless variants of good overcoming evil, but the victory always is accomplished through violence. You know, it's the old story of the cowboy that rides into town, and he's a good-hearted and a good man, but he's in search of justice, and unfortunately, in order for that to be accomplished, there are some people that need killing. And that old story becomes, you know, the great myth, if you will, the great way of talking about justice in so many cultures. Now, however, Wink and lots of others see a new story beginning to take shape, and they use the term retributive justice. I mean, not retributive justice, excuse me. It's redemptive violence and restorative justice, trying to put things back in order, trying to lessen suffering. And when Walter Wink talks about this, he does begin precisely with the whole point of suffering and suggests as the principal tool of crafting a restorative justice solution, compassion. And I wonder if that begins to resonate a little. We're still using that term justice, but begins to resonate a little bit more with the Buddhist side of things.
Absolutely. I think, and this has come up a lot in audience responses when I give a talk about this kind of thing, I think restorative justice is pretty close to what the Buddhists are talking about. I want to tell a little story of sort of how my understanding of this evolved. I remember a conference some decades ago before socially engaged Buddhism had really begun to take off, and people were talking about, you know, what would the Buddhist form of engagement look like, and we're all scratching our heads, and somebody said, well, you have to be one with the victim. And I said, well, you know, it's all well and good to be one with the victim, but if you're going to be one with the victim, if you're going to be, you know, one with things, you got to be one with everything. And, you know, who wants to be one with, you know, the victimizer, the oppressor? And none of us could get past that place. But Thich Nhat Hanh is the one who really showed the way on this, and he obviously did know how to get past that place. And it comes out, I think, very well in his poem that's very famous. Many people know his poem, Please Call Me By My True Names. And in this poem, he talks about all kinds of situations, and he identifies with both sides of the conflict. So, for example, he says, I'm the frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond, and I'm also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I'm the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks, and I'm the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I'm the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. And I'm the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. And I don't mind saying, the first time I read that poem, I was deeply offended. I was infuriated, I have to say. But I couldn't shake it from my mind. And I thought about it. I read it at the beginning of summer. I thought about that poem all summer. And finally, by the end of the summer, I began to understand what he's saying is exactly what Walter Wink is saying in that quote. We are stuck in the tale of the villain who just needs killing, you know, that arms merchant and that pirate, and they do these heinous things, and you just want them to be gone. You just want them wiped out. But Thich Nhat Hanh goes on to show, and again, this is karma, which don't need the term karma. Think of it in terms of cause and effect. The question is, where did that arms merchant come from, and where did that pirate come from? It's causes and conditions of all sorts. So Thich Nhat Hanh says, if I had been born in the village that that pirate was born in and raised under the conditions that he was raised in, I am now the pirate. And, of course, he's right. You know, people get into these things because of poverty and maybe abuse and all sorts of situations. And so it's challenging the idea of the evil person that just needs to be killed. And this is exactly the Buddhist approach. It doesn't really help anything to kill that one person if you're going to leave in place the economic and social and political conditions that produce that person. You know, the real source of the problem are those conditions that produce these people who behave in these ways. So obviously you do need to take action to see to it that that pirate doesn't kill anybody else, but you also need to address those sorts of conditions that bring that killing into practice. So not to, in other words, pretend that we're God up on a cloud and we're so pure and we can look down and just condemn someone as absolutely worthless and vile. Not that kind of thing. We're all in process. We're all produced by causes and conditions, and that's where we need to put a lot more attention than just on this condemnation that we're so quick to jump to.
Sally, I think that's really terrific. I would just add that if there is a measure or a marker of cultural evolution, it really is the changing of our stories, and we all recognize that old story that's in all of our myths and television and movies and so on, the idea of redemptive violence, that sometimes you just need good old-fashioned violence to fix things. And if, in fact, that story is losing some of its legitimacy and some of its potency, and a new story of restorative justice is coming to make more and more sense to us, and I think that's the case, then there's hope. I would just call to everybody's attention on that materials page I've referred to that goes with Sally's interview today. There's a link to a terrific article by Sally called Being Benevolence, The Social Ethics of Engaged Buddhism. So I'm going to turn it back over to Barbara. Thank you so much, Sally. Terrific.
My pleasure. Thank you.